Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. In today's podcast, when President Kennedy was confronted by the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, he formed an executive committee to assist him in deciding his course of action. 20 years later, General Maxwell Taylor reflects on his key role in that committee and in the Cuban Missile Crisis. We hope you enjoy today's podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
General Taylor, in the first week of the Cuban Missile Crisis, what was your perception of the problem and the alternatives, the options to deal with it?
Well, fortunately, there was no question about the problem. The president announced his objective within an hour after seeing the photographs of the missiles. It was to get the missiles out of Cuba. That solved so many things, because if you're drawing up a policy, should consist of an objective and ways to get there. I find in Washington more argument is expended on the first, they never get to the second. Once we got such information as was available, and of course information is never complete or entirely satisfactory, I would say we grouped ourselves into around three possible alternatives. I call them facetiously to talk the missiles out, to squeeze the missiles out, or to shoot the missiles out. The first was to use negotiation. Get in touch with Khrushchev and tell him, we know you're there. Now you have to get out. Let's talk about it. The second was turned out to be the quarantine solution, using a naval blockade or something resembling one, again to show the seriousness of our intent to Khrushchev, but avoid doing anything that might escalate rapidly to points in the sky one knew not what. The third was to shoot them out, which was a surprise attack on the missiles in Cuba. At the outset, without any notification to Khrushchev. And the question, I suppose, will be, why was I for shooting him out?
Sure.
For the following reason. As an artilleryman, when I saw those missiles with their transporter vehicle alongside them, my immediate thought was, they can pull them out and hide them anytime they want to. And that was certainly the case. So if that's the case, and we announced to Khrushchev, we got you down there, certainly at a minimum, he'll hide those missiles in the jungles of Cuba, and we can never get them out unless we invade the island. Well, invading the island was the last thing I thought we should do in our interest.
Tell me why.
We are having trouble in Europe. Berlin was being threatened by Khrushchev. In the Far East, we had the Laotian problem. The Vietnam problem was just burgeoning. And our forces were, relatively speaking, low in numbers and readiness. And once you invade Cuba, what are you going to do with it? You're going to sit on it for an eternity? You couldn't have a seed of a guerrilla warfare against your occupying forces. And again, tie down a large part of our conventional strength. Of course, you shouldn't want that. Mm-hmm. So it's a possibility, if you hit the missiles before they got hidden, at least you'd have that many accounted for in a positive sense. But furthermore, you will have really shaken Khrushchev. He will know we're moving right in. He doesn't want us to invade either. And I felt there's a fair chance of a giving way on that point. So that was the reason why the Joint Chiefs, from the outset, recommended the shoot 'em out aspect. It was argued very eloquently by Bobby Kennedy that that would be or during the act of the Japanese in attacking Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. I never felt my conscience was completely clear because the president on the 9th of September, I believe it was, warned the Soviet that if there are indeed offensive missiles in Cuba, and you say they're not, I will take whatever measures necessary. So he was warned, and he should have taken the consequences. Now, having said that, we found the quarantine here, as you know, the world knows now. The president, after listening to all the pros and cons of these 3 points, the first one dropped out very quickly. It really, they squeeze him out or shoot him out. Mm-hmm. He, not until the 21st, so far as I know, had he finally made up his mind. And then it was not to eliminate the shoot him out, but to use the lesser method first. And then meanwhile, the military were told was to get ready for an attack on the missiles and also ready for an invasion of Cuba.
Now, did you remain, as long as the issue was open, in favor of the shoot 'em out?
I never wavered until my commander-in-chief took another decision. As I had, I'm glad he did, because it proved to be enough.
General, you were loyal to the decision, but I take it you didn't think that the quarantine was going to work.
I thought it had dangerous possibility, because Khrushchev could simply bring his boat, his ship, just short of the quarantine line and stand there and scream to the world over the violation of international law we were indulging in. And meanwhile, start that argument going while his missiles completed their readiness in the island. That was certainly a possibility.
If one had then had to turn to the airstrike, which Mr. Kennedy apparently reserved as an option, what's the disadvantage of doing it later?
Khrushchev could have done two things with the missile: continue to build them up, or hide them, which was always the option, which I thought most likely.
That's what worried you most.
Yeah.
All right. Had you worried about in the first week about the possibility that the airstrike wouldn't suffice, that one would some other reason why it would have to be too big, would lead to invasion or something of the sort?
Yes. We analyzed very carefully the military requirements of an airstrike. And like most military requirements, the longer we studied, the more we needed.
Bigger they got.
I believe that the total number of aircraft which the Air Force wanted to use was around 500. Well, that was a good way to kill the project. Nonetheless, it was an honest estimate, because not only did I have to get the missile on the ground, but meanwhile, Cuba was prickly with SAM missiles, surface-to-air, many of which we knew were operational. So you had to protect your aircraft attacking the ground missile to eliminate the anti-air threat. So yes, that was thought about. And the president very wisely had General Sweeney, a three-star general who would be responsible for the outcome. And he came up and gave a very frank statement. Yes, he would undertake it without any question, but you can't expect me to get them all. Some of the missiles would get away. And these other requirements of collateral use of aircraft, yes, that was a requirement. So it really Sweeney's at the last minute by a straightforward statement, which the Joint Chiefs did not disagree with 1 minute, certainly tilted the president, if he needed any real tilting. Mm-hmm. to the quarantine option as the initial option, to be followed if necessary by the second.
As chairman of the Chiefs, right up until he made the decision, you continued to feel that on balance, the better course would have been to take them out, or as many of them as you could get.
That's right.
Right away. There'd be that fewer less to hide.
Yeah,
I mean, it was...
And the more we got, the greater blow to Khrushchev and his understanding of the danger, what he was entering on.
Yeah. All right, sir. The other decision was made. What was the reaction among your colleagues when the president decided to go quarantine first?
None of us were surprised. By that time, it's quite clear when the evidence was looked at of the magnitude of the military effort that certainly a large majority of his advisors were going in that direction and the president with him.
One question occurs to me. Numbers of civilians have argued since that General Sweeney's plans were more elaborate than they need have been, that a smaller strike might have been technically feasible.
It's always easy to reduce the strength when you're not responsible for the result.
Once it was decided to go forward and implement the quarantine first, Bob McNamara talked to us rather eloquently yesterday about the difference between the quarantine as he and the president understood it and a blockade for normal military purposes, as it would normally be understood. The quarantine was sending a message to Khrushchev. It was not really in their minds, in the top political people's minds, designed to interdict supply. It had a political purpose. And that he went on to say that he had a great deal of difficulty getting the Navy to understand and be satisfied with this very specialized conception of what to them was a traditional naval device, naval military activity. He didn't talk in any detail about his famous controversy with Admiral Anderson, which has been publicized by lots of people, including Robert Kennedy. But he implied that he found it very difficult to maintain the kind of detailed control from the White House that the political purpose of this effort justified in his mind. And I wondered if you have any comment on that from your observation post as chairman of the Chiefs at the time.
I don't blame this all on the Navy. I agreed that if indeed you're going to set up this quarantine line, why not stop their oil and remind Castro what the presence of these missiles was doing to him, and also Khrushchev, as the problem of resupplying his own ally, if indeed we showed that, took that action. So to this day, I would say it was a move we probably should have taken, although the result had not been very great. I had no great feelings when the president decided to limit the blockade to a quarantine and really hope we wouldn't have to stop a Soviet ship. I could understand that, and I could also understand the fact that this was a political card game to a large extent. Mm-hmm. And a strict blockade in the international sense was not required and was probably should not be taken.
The policy that Bob McNamara suggests was critical to the president. Bob Kennedy's account is the same. In managing that quarantine, stresses Khrushchev and Moscow to the exclusion of Castro. It really wasn't, didn't have anything to do with Castro. They weren't thinking about interdicting supply.
Ah, but it's all right to take collateral benefits you don't intend, isn't that right? Or you don't plan.
Right.
That was my point.
Right.
Also, let me ask you, though, this question. At the time, talking about collateral benefit, what was your understanding of government policy toward Castro?
We had been trying to do everything of an unpleasant nature we could covertly for months after the Bay of Pigs. There was no question that we'd like to have him go away. Clearly, we were not prepared to use direct military method, mm-hmm. nor was anybody recommending it to him.
But with that as the policy, it seemed odd not to get the collateral.
Yeah.
That was your feeling.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
When as the week wore on, and the two messages came in from Khrushchev, the favorable one first, and then the one demanding an explicit trade, and it got to be Saturday, the second Saturday. What was your impression of the situation at that point? What did you see and what did you expect?
Well, the first message was incredibly favorable, and it certainly had a one of us said after reading it, that man is either having a case of nerves or he had too much vodka. It wasn't written like the kind of formal message you send back and forth between government. But while we were rejoicing over that, we got number two. We knew the state types had got to this business. And here was what they really wanted to say the first time.
Right.
And of course, the president's action, I thought, was a stroke of genius to say, well, ignore the second one, and use the first one.
Did you expect that was going to have good effect?
You never know, but it's sure worth trying.
Were you aware of Bob Kennedy's visit to Dobrynin that evening?
I was not. Mm-hmm.
The security of that conversation held until Bob's death and his manuscript was discovered.
Yeah. It was,
yeah.
13
yeah.
days.
Yeah. The was that ever revealed to you?
Not until it came up.
Mm-hmm. It's one case of security lasting.
We did pretty well in the security business.
Yes. You've written about the importance of that.
Absolutely.
You want to comment on that a bit?
Well, it's quite obvious then and even more so now that catching Khrushchev completely by surprise was of an enormous value. And that justified the very tight security as the president imposed. That's security of that sort is double-edged. It made it enormously difficult for the military to be preparing to invade an island and move 250,000 men into position and not tell anybody. Every day I'd go over with my colleagues and the chief saying, for God's sake, get that president, give us some elbow room. And I'd come back with one little piece and they'd be very discontented. We did make it, but it was how good we would have performed militarily in all the complex interlocking activities. No one ever knew. Mm-hmm. It was a magnificent exercise, the best exercise in the time of peace we ever had in the military service. The political advantage of the surprise certainly justified the pain we were having in the Pentagon because of it.
You give me an example or two of how that assembly of forces was hampered by the restrictions you were operating under.
At the outset, the first day, I was justified, authorized, that is the 16th, to tell just the Joint Chiefs themselves, and he couldn't tell anybody. The next we got them to be, they could talk to their number two, the vice chief of staff. And then little by little, I get permission to tell the man who was going to land in Cuba, tell Admiral Dennison, who was going to conduct the whole operation.
Right.
Admiral Dennison is a choleric man by nature. And when we brought him in and told him this and how soon he had to be ready, I've never seen such a red face. And I sympathize with every drop of blood he had in his veins. But he had a very fine sailor, he took charge. And we put together a communication system that didn't exist before. Mm. Commanders had never thought of this business and got them all working. And the Joint Chiefs as individuals going out and going from senior unit to senior unit to be sure he knew what he was entitled to know.
So that if there had been, it had been necessary to move some escalatory steps up the ladder, you feel reasonably confident that you were prepared.
Well, the escalation would do you invaded, don't you? In which case, with the combined effort of the Navy, the Air Force, Marines, Army.
Is that what you foresaw for the next week?
I'm not sure I understand.
If on the Saturday, or on the Sunday, the second Sunday, if the Soviets had simply insisted on their second message of Saturday, stood fast on that,
No, we still had the option of attacking the missiles in Cuba.
So that would have been.
But we were working hard, round the clock, literally around the clock, in the Pentagon, in the field. We didn't say when to get ready; it was now. And the time record in which we were perceptibly ready. I say perceptibly because you never know what's going on, whether you're ready until you practice it. And we never had time to do that.
Mm-hmm. When Khrushchev came in instead on the Sunday with a message accepting our formal terms, Robert Kennedy has written about the unhappiness of one of your colleagues that we didn't go ahead and invade anyway. You got any comment on that?
Bombay had a contact with the Joint Chiefs I never had.
They never said that to you?
Never had that to
me. Mm-hmm. Was it unexpected to you? Was that outcome unexpected to you? Or can't you really remember?
I was so sure we had them over a barrel. I never worried much about the final outcome. But I mean, what things might happen in between?
Whether the outcome to which I'm referring is Khrushchev's acceptance of our
well, at some time he had to accept. Yeah, I never expected on that particular day.
Okay, you thought it was going to go wrong.
Unless he's crazy and full of vodka, but I assumed his colleagues in Moscow would take care of them.
You have written in your retrospect in the Washington Post on October 5, 82, as I remember, the 20th year, that you don't recall any concern about the strategic balance or any fear of nuclear exchange in this whole period. Now, some of the civilians do recall worries about the time of that second Saturday. Worries that really run to two or three steps up the ladder of escalation. The Soviets don't accept our demand. There follows an airstrike. The Soviets then feel impelled to strike the missiles in Turkey. The Turks call on NATO for support. We feel we have to do something in Europe. The Soviets then launch a nuclear exchange. Something like that was in some of their minds. I take it not in yours.
They never expressed it to a military ear, I'll say that.
That's interesting.
Not at all. It's the nature of some people, if they can't have a legitimate worry, they create them. And apparently they had some of that in the group you're speaking of.
In your mind, there was no legitimacy in this work.
Not the slightest.
Because Khrushchev could look up that ladder.
If it was irrational, I still expected his colleagues to look at him.
Mm-hmm. And at the top of the ladder, if I understand what you saw correctly, the imbalance between the damage we could do to the Soviets and they could do to us in a nuclear exchange was so, so enormous.
Of course.
That would restrain them.
Yeah. But why didn't Khrushchev see this at the outset? Because they bound to lose with conventional forces right on our doorstep.
Yes.
He couldn't win.
Yes.
Except my only explanation that I can find that has a certain appeal is that the meeting of Khrushchev with President Kennedy in Vienna had so impressed him with the unreadiness of this young man to head a great country like the United States, plus the experience that he had seen in the Bay of Peg, that he said, you can shove this man around any place you want. Well, he was wrong.
It looks as though that's just what he was trying. Some of the civilians deeply regret that they didn't have the wit to warn Castro against this sort of thing in the spring of 62. Because by the time the president issued his warning, of course, the Russian operation was well underway. But is there anything that you can recall that would have stimulated anybody to issue that kind of warning to the Soviets?
Not the nuclear weapon aspect. But we knew that Castro was getting enormous shipments of conventional equipment. We could count them.
Yes.
We saw on the pier. So the fact that an unusual effort to arm Cuba was going on. But meanwhile, we were stimulating that, whether we wanted to or not, by our mongoose operation. And Khrushchev says in the memoirs, and at least on this occasion, I believe him, he was convinced the United States could not accept the enormous embarrassment of the defeat in the Bay of Pigs.
Okay, sir.
General, I want to be sure we get you to state the lessons you want to state that you draw from this whole experience. Before I ask you any more questions, I want to ask you that general question. What are the lessons that we haven't happened to go over that you have felt come out of this experience?
Well, obviously there's a long list of lessons, for example, of a technical military nature. You're talking about a lesson
for the man who was in this top group. It's from that perspective I want to get you.
Well, I'm thinking about the lessons that the future president.
Yes.
Well, I'll miss a few, but I'll give you some of the most important in my mind. The first is comes from the contrast between the disaster of the Bay of Pigs and the success of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Yet the same president, almost the same advisor, were responsible for each one. Why were they so much better in the Cuban Missile Crisis? Well, they knew each other. There had been strangers before. Virtually none of them knew anything about the machinery of government, how to start the machine, stop it, put in the gas, and those things. And furthermore, they really did not know each other's responsibility. There were overcautions in treading on the next fellow's turf. There were not a team, just a group of very able individuals with an insufficient background. What had happened? Well, they had the shaking experience of the Bay of Pigs. They had over a year of working together. They knew each other. They liked each other. A very harmonious group. That was the Camelot gang, and they liked being in Camelot. I was flattered to be allowed to come into Catalan. So that the lesson is, any new administration, for God's sakes, avoid getting into a real crisis until you've been around at least a year. Number two, I would say the importance of secrecy. A president must be able to do things secretly. Don't quote the First Amendment to me. I don't give a damn. The interest of this country is too great to prevent a president, by law, by custom, from being able to keep a secret for 8 days as he did. Mm-hmm. Because without that secrecy, I don't know how this thing would have come out. Mm-hmm. The third is the fact that nuclear weapons as such really did not play a part in this, in the outcome of the Cuban Missile Crisis. We had a great superiority over the Soviet. It's true, we were put our sunk the B-52s in the air to fly back and forth over the Atlantic within range of the Soviet radar to remind them we had these planes, and they did have a nuclear weapon. And that allowed us to scratch it off and concentrate on the politics and the use of conventional forces in this operation.
But we were overwhelmingly superior in conventional
forces. Where we were. Yeah. And that leads to the next lesson, which we learn from the enemy, from Khrushchev. His folly in trying to accomplish what he sought to accomplish right in the backyard of the United States. I often have occasion to quote a Roman wise man who said very simply, a cock has great authority on his own dunghill. We're on our dunghill, and Khrushchev was a long way from his dunghill, which represented his basis of strength.
Incidentally, when President Kennedy finally decided to, on the second Saturday, to disarm the missiles in Turkey, those old missiles in Turkey, I take it, having disarmed them, he was going to announce it to try to demonstrate that we weren't there. There was nothing there worth the Russians bombing. Did that trouble you at all?
Yes, it had been a great mistake to do it right in the middle of this thing. I was not aware of the fact the president had discussed with State the desirability of getting the missiles out of Turkey.
I see.
Until this time. And I opposed, obviously, when you got the guy on the run, why they come back, we'll give you a piece of cake. Mm-hmm. Why do that? No sense of why, whatever. It would again show these uncertain Americans, they're not sure of themselves. It's quite true, the missiles were outmoded, and I was very happy to get them out after a very careful negotiation with Turkey and replacing them by the presence of a nuclear submarine.
But you were not persuaded by whatever concerns the president had to do this precipitous act in the middle.
I didn't know he was going to do anything. I thought we had talked him out of it.
I see. All right. Well, I didn't mean to get in the way of your general point. My understanding, though, was this may have been a pre-learning of that lesson of yours about don't act in the other man's neighborhood. The other man.
Well, strategists, if we have someone in Washington, bears that in mind when it thinks about moving in the Persian Gulf, for example.
Yes. Are there any others, sir? I've got one I want to ask you about.
I would say those are the primary ones.
Let me ask you whether, in your mind, there are any negative ones. Are there any... This was a great success. Did we learn anything out of it that we shouldn't have, that got us into trouble?
Well, I can't be sure. I know what you're referring to. I can't be sure. But one of the errors we made in Vietnam, after waiting and being cautious in using air power against North Vietnam until we could see the reaction in Moscow and Peking, that was justified. We continued to be nothing but gradualists, bit by bit. I've always had the feeling the success of quarantine over my favorite shooting mat made a great impression on many minds here in Washington, and the feeling of never overreact. It doesn't matter if you underreact. Became accepted, not formally, but mentally at least. And I think that accounted for some of those actions in the Johnson administration.
The idea, take the low-level step first, and wait and see before you take the next level
it
step.
It seems beautiful, doesn't it? And in many cases, yeah. But you have to adjust to every changing situation.
That raises an interesting side issue. President Johnson was at a number of the meetings of the executive committee. I gather he mostly followed the sound custom he'd set for himself as vice president of not saying anything. Did you have much impression of his thoughts at the time?
Only a very slightly a phrase or two. Yes, he was clearly a hawk. But again, as you say, just as in a meeting of the National Security Council, he almost never volunteered to comment. He never pushed anything out in the air.
Well, it was his view, as I understand it, that the vice president must never be seen. Controversy with the president.
He's the only... Only a vice president I've heard took that position. Of course, I never felt I was arguing against the president. I was ventilating issues with my colleagues, knowing the president, hoping the president was listening. The vice president's conscience was too sensitive.
Yes.
In this game.
Well, I think that could very, I think that's very possible. One thing we we have not really discussed are your relations with the other chiefs. Yesterday, the Secretary of Defense, then, Robert Kennedy, spoke very warmly of his relationship with the President and the relationship they both had with you as Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and the essentiality of that closeness in conducting any operation where a possibility of escalation to a nuclear stage existed. Bob McNamara was saying, in effect, that this kind of closeness and close control and close relationship among these three people is essential where a nuclear weapons may come into play. In that, I thought, I didn't have a chance to challenge him on it, but I thought he spoke of you as though you were Chief of Staff of the Army, Navy, and Air Force, as though the Army's proposals for unification back in 1947 had actually been put in effect. Did you feel yourself in any way in command of the Chiefs of Staff?
If I ever should have, they would have put me in my place. No, of course not. You are the number one among equals. At least that was the attitude then. It's impossible to take all the chiefs committee every time you want to get military advice to a president, especially when you're doing it secretly. So our procedure was simply this. Bob and I attend as far as I know every meeting that bore on the question in any serious way. I immediately went back, and sometimes at odd hours in the night, evening, and calling in advance to the chief, meet me in my office. And would then tell him everything I had learned. I'd also be able to say, what are the questions which are worrying the president? In other words, what is he considering doing? And if so, should we put in a recommendation? Mm-hmm. We are below the senior military advisor of the president. We have an obligation. I didn't want to be as we were in the Bay of Pigs. In which case, we'd sit down and argue it out with ourselves. Now, usually, I would say I agreed with the rest. In other words, I carried over a unanimous opinion. Not always. There was one or two inclined to think we were going too quietly, not sufficiently ambitiously, let's say, in using the bar, because we all agreed that we have this fellow with the barrel. Let's get the most out of it. Mm-hmm. In which case, I would guarantee I would take any contrary view of it and give that to President orally, along with my view, which was always a majority view, if not a consensus. And then we'd argue, they have the meeting, and I'd go back again to the chief. Well, inevitably, they say, now, what did you say in defending our case? Yes. How strong were you? Well, once I upset him at the outset, I didn't say a damn word. Well, they almost fell off their chair. I said, and why? Because I had the best international lawyer in the United States and a former Secretary of State to carry the case. All I said was, me too. That was denaturism. So they were always a little leery of whether their case was properly presented. I got tired of that about 4 or 5 days and said, look, you're a brave lot. You say, I'll hold your coat and you go over and take on the president. I'll arrange for you all to go over. And they were happy about it. Mm-hmm. And they had the meeting you know of, which didn't bring out very much. But it made them feel so much better. Every chief has his only conscience. Am I doing right? Have I done all I should to press my view? Many times, I service you. That's the way it worked.
Were they as conscious of the Bay of that aspect of the Bay of Pigs as the people at the White House were? That is to say, in the Bay of Pigs, the chiefs were hesitant. They didn't speak up fully. It wasn't their operation, and they didn't press their views.
Well, I can answer that very readily, because one of the lessons the Bay of Pigs was a failure to speak. And President Kennedy, I was the so-called military representative of the president in the White House.
Yes.
From the 1st of July, 61, to October, 62. I told him one of the most important things is to tell the chiefs that you expect them to be aggressive in giving advice. And furthermore, not just military advice. You men have had wild international experience. Speak up, because I don't think in terms of military aspect, economic, political. It's just one ball of wax to me. And I want advisors who also see that ball of wax. Well, he took that and came over to the Pentagon and gave the pep talk, which was recorded and made a White House directive telling these chiefs. So, and the chiefs, their successors, were happy as likes. That's what they wanted all the time. Now you had written evidence. It was not just the military aspect, but the national aspect.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.